You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 13, given in Dornach on April 2, 1920. Especially with regard to three sets of facts that we must now begin to discuss, the more materialistic trend in medicine may possibly begin to turn toward our spiritual, scientifically oriented school of thought. This will, most probably, be the case with our observations of everything involved in tumor formation and possible cures for cancer, a truly rational view of so-called mental illnesses, and our knowledge of the therapeutic use of external remedies, liniments, ointments, and the like. We can scarcely hope that conventional physical examinations, unguided by spiritual scientific insights, will suffice to approach subjects such as the development of growths that culminate in carcinomas. Connections are omnipresent in the natural world, and today's psychiatry is in such a sorry state because there is no human conscious connection between it and conventional pathology and therapy, two fields that are perhaps the most receptive to spiritual scientific viewpoints. It will be especially necessary to consider everything spiritual science can say about these topics. Today, all that is needed is to consider my writings. You will find that they have already said quite a lot in this regard. We need to take into account all aspects of the etheric body's intervention in the human organism. It should not be said that clairvoyance is absolutely necessary in order to be able to talk about the etheric body's activity in the human organism, because a great many processes that simply oppose the etheric body's activities demonstrate that the etheric body is not active, or at least not properly active, in a specific way. To come to valid ideas on this subject, we will need to look at inflammations and their consequences, as well as at tumor development as a starting point for the destruction of the human organism, so to speak. In the case of tumor development, very justifiable attempts are now being made to avoid surgery. Because of social circumstances that will need to be changed, not outer conditions, but social circumstances in which medicine plays a part, namely issues of public hygiene, this very justified ideal cannot always be implemented. The important point here is to create a substitute for what the surgeon's knife does or does not accomplish. And it certainly is effective in some respects, but fails to accomplish anything in others. There are, undoubtedly, many people who advocate surgery today simply because they have no way of knowing about anything else, but who will immediately take the opposite approach as soon as information becomes available. You do not need me to describe the character of inflammatory processes in their various specific forms, organ by organ. I am sure this is well known. But what is not so well known is the overriding process common to all inflammatory processes. This common process can best be characterized by saying that in every true inflammation, whether very large or very small, and in everything that can lead from inflammation to ulceration, spiritual scientific investigation will reveal that the human etheric body as a whole is still functioning. This means that we can count on being able to do something to normalize and redistribute the etheric body's effect, which has become sluggish in a single direction, so that the person's entire etheric body will then work in a healthy way. In inflammations, the etheric body's activity is guided only in specific directions, whereas the activity of a healthy etheric body extends into the organism in all the appropriate directions. In essence, we can say that if the etheric body as a whole is still healthy, but has become sluggish with regard to a particular organ system, we will be able to discover agents, which we will discuss later, that are capable of stimulating it to develop its universal activity, if I may call it that, in this specific direction. It is different in tumor formations of any sort. In this case, certain processes in the physical body function directly as enemies of the etheric body's activity. These processes in the physical body simply rebel against the etheric body's activity. As a consequence, the etheric body is no longer effective in these areas of the physical body. The etheric body, however, has a great capacity for regeneration, and spiritual scientific observation shows that if we can remove the obstruction and overcome the enemy that counteracts the etheric body's activity in a certain area, we will indeed be able to deal with the problem. With tumors, then, it is a matter of using natural processes to stimulate the removal of the physical processes opposing the etheric body, so that it can once again work in a spot its effects formerly could not reach. This will become very important in the treatment of carcinomas. If carcinomas are observed objectively, it is quite evident that in spite of their many different forms, they all constitute a revolt on the part of certain physical forces against the forces of the etheric body. The cornification, C-O-R-N-I-F-I-C-A-T-I-O-N, cornification, that typically appears in internal carcinomas and is less prominent in carcinomas located nearer the surface, although the tendency persists, shows us that a physical formative process has overcome the etheric formative process that should be present at that particular spot. A careful study of these two phenomena, inflammation and ulceration on the one hand, and tumor formation on the other, eventually makes it obvious that they are true polar opposites. Having said that this is obvious, let me also ask you to recall your experience of carcinomas located close to the surface. What happens in such cases can frequently be confused with pseudo-abscesses, at least in certain respects. Above all, therefore, it will be important to study this polarity more precisely. Medical nomenclature, that is, at least medieval, if not exactly ancient, is often very disturbing in such instances. I am not referring to the historical medieval period, but to the Middle Ages of nomenclature that lie in the quite recent past. It is not totally correct to describe tumors as neoplasms. There is nothing new about them, except in the very trivial sense of not having been there before. They are not new in the sense of growing out of the ground of the skin-enclosed organism of their own accord. They come about because the physical body opposes the etheric body so strongly that the outer body aligns itself with aspects of outer nature that are inimical to the human being. Tumor development offers easy access to all sorts of outer influences. Here again, it is important to study the image that contrasts with all these processes. Let me point you first in the direction of studying the development of viscum, mistletoe, in outer nature. Although we do initially need to pay attention to how viscum species develop on other plants, this is not the most important consideration. The parasitic nature of mistletoe is certainly the most important consideration for botany. But as far as our study of the connection between outer non-human nature and the human being is concerned, a much more important consideration is that mistletoe, because it grows on other plants, on trees, is forced to carry out its vegetative growth in a different annual rhythm. For example, it has already done flowering before the trees it grows on have begun putting out leaves in spring. It is a winter plant and rather aristocratic in its behavior. It uses the foliage of its host trees to protect it from the intense light of summer and does not expose itself to the most intense rays of the sun. In line with the processes we described the day before yesterday, we must always see the sun simply as a representative of the effects of light, but this would need to be studied in the context of physics and does not belong in this discussion. We cannot completely avoid what has crept into our language as a result of somewhat inaccurate observations of nature. Mistletoe's whole way of growing and thriving by attaching itself to other plants is especially important because it allows this plant to acquire very specific forces that can be described more or less as follows. Thanks to the forces it acquires, it rejects the intentions of organizational forces that develop in a straight line and demands their opposite. Here, too, the situation will become clear only when we understand it in the following way. Here is a schematic representation, there's a blackboard drawing on page 190, of a spot in the human body that uses its own forces to revolt against all the etheric forces working into it. The etheric forces are backed up and brought to a standstill, and as a result, something that looks like a new growth comes about. Mistletoe is a remedy that counteracts the etheric pocket that has formed there. It pulls the etheric forces back into this spot where they did not want to go. You could verify this situation yourself through observation if you ever have a coincidental opportunity to observe the effect of mistletoe on the expulsion of the placenta. In this case, you would be able to study mistletoe's tendency to oppose straight-line organization. Mistletoe causes the placenta to be retained in the human organism. That is, in its own way, it does the opposite of straight-line organization. The ability to cause retention of the placenta, that is, to bring the usual organizational process to a standstill, is one of the most important characteristics of mistletoe's effective processes. Of course, in the case of more subtle activities in the human organism that have the same basis as placental retention, this effect is much less readily apparent. But the same force that is strongly active when mistletoe counteracts the straight-line organizational tendency also confronts us in any other images we get of mistletoe's effect. Having noticed that mistletoe counters the etheric body's failure to take hold of the physical body to the right extent, if we then induce a specific mistletoe effect, the etheric body may take hold of the physical body too strongly, resulting in convulsions. In other cases, the effects of mistletoe can cause the peculiar sensation of being in constant danger of falling over. These consequences are also related to the fact that mistletoe essentially promotes pollution. For example, you can see in every instance, even in connection with the development of epilepsy, for example, that mistletoe has the capacity of opposing the human organism. This ability has less to do with the fact that it is a parasite, however, than with the fact that it allows nature to give it a free helping of sausage, to use an expression that at least the Viennese among you will understand. It is granted a special favor, an exception to the rule, in that it refuses to thrive in the usual season, to flower in the spring and then bear fruit. Instead, it does these things in a different season, during the winter. By doing so, it retains forces that then counteract the normal course of events. If it is not too offensive, we may say that if we look at how nature behaves in the development of mistletoe, nature seems to have gone crazy. It does everything at the wrong time when it comes to mistletoe. This behavior, however, is exactly what we will put to use when the human organism goes physically crazy, which is what happens in the development of carcinomas. The point is to develop an understanding of such relationships. There can be no doubt that mistletoe is the substance that, if potentized, will allow us to replace the surgeon's knife in treating tumors. It is only a question of handling mistletoe fruit in the right way. But in connection with other forces in mistletoe itself, of course, so as to turn it into a remedy. Mistletoe's craziness is also evident in the fact that its continued existence and reproduction are always dependent on being moved from place to place by birds. Mistletoe would surely die out if birds did not repeatedly carry its means of reproduction from one tree to another. Curiously enough, its reproductive structures also choose to pass through the birds themselves, in that they are first taken into the birds' bodies and later evacuated so that they can sprout on another tree. All these findings, if observed objectively, lead to insight into mistletoe's entire process of development. The gluey substance in mistletoe, in particular, needs to be brought into the right connection with a triturating agent, so as to gradually produce a very high potency of the substance. Next, this substance needs to be specially adapted to different organs. I will go into detail later, in part by considering the origin of the mistletoe, specifically what kind of a tree it grew on. But it will also be important to produce remedies that are based on the interaction of this gluey substance with specific metallic substances, which can even be derived from the metal content of other plants. For example, the interaction that comes about by combining and potentizing mistletoe from apple trees with silver salts will result in a remedy that can be highly effective against all abdominal cancers. You must understand that I need to speak cautiously about these subjects, because although the basic thrust of what I am saying is absolutely correct and well-founded in spiritual scientific research, actual therapeutic measures depend totally on how mistletoe's constituents are processed, and the knowledge needed to produce such remedies is scarcely available yet. At this point, of course, spiritual science would be able to work favorably only when it could actually constantly collaborate with the clinical process that is the basis of so much of what other physicians do. This is what makes the relationship between spiritual science and medicine so difficult. These two approaches, the opportunity for clinical observation and spiritual scientific research, must still remain separated because of modern social conventions. It will become evident that we will get nowhere unless these two paths are brought together. The important point will be to gather empirical evidence, because the only way you will be able to impress the outer world is if you can at least supply verification in the form of outer clinical reports and so on. The need for these proofs is more an outer than an inner one. If we simply proceed methodically, we will be able to prove that the effect of mistletoe really is based on what I have just explained. According to what I said here a few days ago, tree trunks are more like outgrowths of soil substance, little hills in which the vegetative aspect is still present and which support the growth of everything else that belongs to the tree. When mistletoe also grows there, its roots grow toward the ground as it makes itself at home up there in the tree. Thus, it is to be expected that if we conduct experiments with plants that have the same crazy, aristocratic attitude as mistletoe, but lack its bohemian, parasitic quality, we will see similar characteristics, and this is indeed the case. If we begin to investigate winter plants with regard to their tendency to counteract normal tendencies of the human organism, and specifically normal tendencies to develop illnesses, we can expect that plants that find it appropriate to put forth flowers in winter will all have similar effects. For example, if we simply extend our experiments to include Helleborus niger, the common Christmas rose, we will find that it induces similar effects. We must take into account, however, the contrast between male and female that I have at least begun to characterize. With Helleborus niger, we can hardly expect to achieve clearly visible results in women, but results will be perceptible in cases of tumor development in men if we use a similar processing method, but produce a higher potency than the one I indicated in the case of viscum. If we work in this way, we must consider relationships of this sort, whether a plant thrives in winter or summer, whether it derives its effect from behaving like mistletoe, or whether it is more inclined toward the earth. Mistletoe does not like to be close to the earth, but black hellebora, or Christmas rose, does, and is therefore more closely related to the male system of forces, which in turn is more closely related to earthly factors, as I explained a few days ago. The female system of forces is, instead, more closely connected to supra-earthly factors. These differences absolutely must be taken into account. It will prove especially important to acquire a certain insight into the processes of nature. This is why, in the attempt to illustrate the forces in the outer world, I turned to concepts of character such as bohemian, aristocratic, and crazy, which can serve us very well and are not at all inadequate with respect to what we are considering, to show what these forces are like. Having acquired such concepts, we will then encounter the characteristic difference between a remedy's external and internal effects. But before we take this difference into account, we must also look at ideas that can introduce it in the right way. For example, there is one thing that absolutely must be studied with regard to certain illnesses that are now appearing. In the case of these new types of illness, which I pointed out yesterday, we will have to study what happens, for example, when we expose Carbo vegetabilis to marsh gas for some time, simply by leaving it lying in the gas. We proceed with trituration only after the carbon is sufficiently impregnated with gas. The result will be externally effective in some way, in the form of ointments and the like, especially if the trituration is performed in conjunction with substances that can enhance the effect further. It is simply a question of discovering the right technique. If triturated with talc, for example, according to certain technical methods that we will certainly be able to ascertain, the resulting remedy will be very effective if used externally in the form of ointments and the like. The important thing for us now, however, is to understand such a process. We will not understand it if we do not first sharpen our vision by learning healthy thinking with regard to psychiatry. Please believe me that spiritual scientists are actually angered, if I may express myself drastically, by the use of the German word Geisteskrankheit, spirit illness, for psychiatric illness. It is ridiculous to use this term, because the spirit is always healthy and incapable of falling ill. What happens is that the spirit's ability to express itself is disturbed by the physical organism. There is never any real illness in the life of the spirit or soul. Symptoms appear, but that is all. Now, however, we must sharpen our vision for concrete, individual symptoms. Perhaps you will see the first indications and then the further development of something like religious mania. As you know, these terms are not all precise, because the nomenclature in this field is extremely confused. Nevertheless, we do need to use these words. All this, of course, is merely symptomatic. But assuming that something like this develops, the important point will be to gain a picture of its entire process of development. Once we have acquired this picture, however, and encounter an individual with this symptomatology, we will have to look carefully at any abnormalities in the process of lung formation, not in the respiratory process, but in the lung's formative process, in pulmonary metabolism. You see, the term brain disease is also not totally correct. If the term Geisteskrankheit is completely false, then brain disease is actually half false, because any degeneration in the brain is always secondary. The primary factor in all illnesses never lies in the upper part of the body, but always in the lower part, in the organs belonging to the four systems of the liver, kidneys, heart, and lungs. In the case of someone who is losing interest in outer life and beginning to brood and act out delusions, the most important concern is always to get an idea of the constitution of this person's pulmonary process. This is extremely important. Similarly, if we observe someone in whom obstinacy, pig-headedness, and self-righteousness appear, indicating a certain immobility or rigidity in thinking, this should lead us to investigate the status of liver function in the person in question. In such people, it is always the inner organic chemistry that is not functioning properly. Even what we have become accustomed to calling softening of the brain, in common parlance, is entirely secondary. The primary factor in psychiatric disorders, even if it is sometimes more difficult to observe, always lies in the lower organ systems. This accounts for the often dishearteningly low rate of success of psychotherapy. In fact, psychotherapy can accomplish more in the case of organic diseases than it can in so-called psychiatric disorders. We will have to get used to treating psychiatric disorders with medications. This is crucial, and it is the second of two areas in which outer trends in medicine will have to find a way to approach spiritual science. In this area, well-trained psychologists will always prove to be the best observers. An extraordinary amount lies hidden in our psychological life, with all its great variety and its frequently merely suggestive effects. We will, gradually, have to achieve a real capacity for observation in this field. It is not true that human beings are simple or simply constituted in terms of their abilities, by which I also mean the capabilities of the bodily state of organization, which is the tool of a person's spiritual organization. Let me give an example. Strange as it may sound, it is absolutely possible for someone we are obliged to describe as an idiot, as a feeble-minded person, to have abilities that allow him or her to come up with comments that are witty and brilliant. This is truly possible, because feeble-mindedness can make a person very open to suggestion, very receptive to reflecting the mysterious influences of his or her surroundings. There are very interesting observations to be made in the field of pathological cultural history. We must not name names in reporting the results of such observations, which would detract from their credibility. It is not right to name names, but it is an idiosyncrasy of the field of journalism in particular, that people with feeble minds can become good journalists because their slow wit puts them in a position to reflect the opinion of the times rather than giving their own obstinate views. For example, dull-witted journalists reflect the opinion of the times to such an extent that their accounts are much more interesting than those of self-possessed, strong-minded journalists. We learn much more about what humanity as a whole is thinking from weak-minded journalists than from strong-minded ones, who are always intent on developing opinions of their own. This is an extreme case, but it occurs over and over again. It is the ultimate disguise of the actual state of affairs. We fail to notice the presence of feeble-mindedness because its initial manifestation can be quite brilliant. In everyday life, such a circumstance doesn't make much difference. Ultimately, no harm is done if our newspapers are written by the feeble-minded, as long as they present only good things. In extreme cases, however, where the limit is reached and this tendency develops into a form of illness, we need to acquire a very unbiased eye for observing the soul conditions of people who then fall into the domain of psychiatry. Since we will not always be able to judge by the disguises their soul activity has assumed, we will have to make our assessments on the basis of deeper lying symptoms. We must always realize that it is easiest of all to succumb to error when we are observing psychological states, because the most important question is not whether the person expresses intelligent thoughts, for example, but whether he or she tends to repeat these intelligent thoughts more often than the context necessitates. How an individual expresses his or her thoughts is the important concern. Whether a person repeats thoughts very frequently or utters them without supplying transitions is more important than whether the thoughts themselves are intelligent or stupid. A completely healthy person can still be stupid, merely physiologically stupid, not pathologically stupid. It is also possible for someone to express a clever thought and still be predisposed to psychiatric illness and even succumb to it. We can see this most readily if the person in question suffers from omission of thoughts or frequent repetition of thoughts. The person who suffers from frequent repetitions always has a potential for illness that is related to a formative lung process that is not in order, while the one who suffers from omission of thoughts always has an inherent predisposition to a liver process that is not functioning properly. Other symptoms fall in between. These questions, too, can be studied in real life. For example, in cases where a substance is used as a food for pleasure rather than as a medicine, at least in the ordinary sense, we can see that coffee has a very clear and pronounced effect on the entire symptomatic process of our psychological life. And incidentally, I have often mentioned this before, at least in certain circles. We should not place any value on such effects, although they are indeed present, because reliance on them simply makes the soul sluggish. It is possible to compensate for deficient logic by consuming coffee. That is, coffee consumption predisposes the organism to release more forces for purposes of logic than is the case when a person does not drink coffee. Thus, drinking a lot of coffee should be one of the habits of modern journalists, so that they do not have to chew on their pen so much in order to connect one thought to another. This is one aspect of the question. In contrast, tea consumption prevents us from always thinking one thought to the next in a pedantic professorial fashion, which, if taken to extremes, is not at all witty but bores people, because we are constantly subjecting them to the precision of our own logical processes. Certain professions are now in decline, but their old state of organization could have made good use of an external means of becoming as witty as possible without inwardly being so. Members of these professions should have been advised to drink tea. Just as coffee is a good drink for journalists, tea is an extremely effective drink for diplomats, who have great need of the ability to habitually toss off disjointed thoughts that allow one to appear witty. Such things are important to know, because if we can acknowledge them properly, and have the necessary moral soul attitude, we know, as a matter of course, that in a moral lifestyle, these abilities must be promoted in some other non-dietary way. Such connections are extraordinarily important as a means of educating ourselves about certain natural relationships. Similarly, in a cultural context, it is important to look, for example, at the very low sugar consumption that was once typical in Russia, in contrast to the very high consumption typical in the Western or English-speaking world. We will discover that where psychological development has not paralyzed such manifestations, people present a very clear imprint of what they ingest. Russians express a certain selfless devotion to the outer world and have less ego awareness, which they substitute for on a level that is theoretical at best. This is related to low sugar consumption. In contrast, the British possess a strong organically based sense of self that is related to high sugar consumption. Here, however, it is less important to look at actual consumption levels than at people's sugar cravings, because the level of consumption always develops as the result of a craving, out of the longing to enjoy something. That is why it is especially important to take a look at such cravings. Looking to the organ systems of the lower human body as the origin of so-called psychiatric disorders points you in the direction of interactions within the human being that should not be disregarded from the joint perspective of pathology and therapy. These interactions between what I have described in simple terms as the upper and lower areas of the human being must always be taken into account with regard to both pathology and therapy. If we neglect to do so, we will never achieve a proper view of the effect of outer influences through which we want to work on a patient. It makes a big difference whether we apply the effects of warmth or water to a patient's feet or head. But we cannot bring reason to bear on these questions without first becoming aware of the great differences in the functioning of the upper and lower parts of the human being. This is why we will now discuss outer effects on the human being, to the extent that our particular subject permits. The end of Lecture 13.